From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. The King of Saudi Arabia and the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, met members of Jamal Khashoggi's family today and expressed their condolences about his death. Earlier, Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan told lawmakers the journalist was brutally murdered in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul as part of a premeditated operation. Erdogan rejected the Saudi claim that his death was accidental. BBC diplomatic correspondent Paul Adams joins us now from London. And Paul, Erdogan had promised before today's speech to reveal the naked truth about Khashoggi's death. But did he really do that?
No, I don't think he did. I mean, to a large extent, he's already done it through this relentless drip-feeding of salacious detail through loyal press organs. But those expecting him to come out with his remaining Trump cards, notably the audio recording, were sorely disappointed. And I think there's a reason for that. I think it would have seemed a little unseemly for the president to lay all this grisly detail out himself. He's aware that international pressure has been steadily mounting on the Saudi authorities. And so if he is still holding one or two Trump cards in his hand, perhaps he's waiting for the moment at which he decides to play them.
So what did we learn today that was new?
Well, he did lay out the narrative that we're all sort of broadly speaking familiar with. There are a few newish details. He talked about a team of Saudi officials who had arrived after Mr. Khashoggi's first visit to the consulate, which was a couple of days before he was murdered. It's thought that that team was in some way an advance party doing some reconnaissance for the mission that unfolded on October the 2nd. And I suppose the point of all of that was to underline the premeditated nature of what happened. I think one thing President Erdogan wanted everyone to go away believing strongly was that this notion of it being a rogue operation is simply not credible, and that what remains is for the Saudi authorities to answer the key questions. Where is the body? And who gave the orders?
The one thing that he did not say was the name of the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman. And if he wanted to appear tough on this murder, and if he wanted to appear tough on the Saudis, why wouldn't he call the Crown Prince out?
I think that is probably the question that people are asking. By way of responding, I suppose I'd say one of the most significant things that President Erdogan said was, "I have no doubt about the sincerity of King Salman." I think that was very, very telling. The fact that he said that and made no reference at all to the Crown Prince tells you that President Erdogan still wants to maintain a channel of diplomatic, of cordial relations with the Saudi leadership at the highest level. But on the other hand, he wants to be seen to undermine subtly the position of the Crown Prince by not mentioning him, but by talking repeatedly about, you know, who gave the orders. I think that tells you quite a bit about what President Erdogan is trying to do. He's trying to weaken the role of the Crown Prince, perhaps even to persuade his father that it's a liability to have him as the Crown Prince at all.
To make a change, right. Now, he did put some pressure on the Saudis. He said that he wanted the 18 suspects that are detained in Saudi Arabia to be tried in Turkish courts. Significance of that, and do you think that it could actually happen?
I think it was significant in as much as it appealed to his audience. There was a lot of talk of Turkish pride, Turkish sovereignty. But no, it's not going to happen. There is zero chance, I would say, of the Saudi authorities yielding the 18 people, some of whom are quite senior. That would place the investigation and the truth, if you like, way beyond the reach of the Saudi authorities to control. I mean, they're already struggling to control the narrative. That would be the end of it. So I don't think that's going to happen, but it certainly appealed to President Erdogan's audience.
It has been 3 weeks since Khashoggi disappeared, and the firestorm, the diplomatic firestorm that it has unleashed is sometimes hard to believe. Do you think that we'll ever really know through all of this chaos, what happened to Jamal Khashoggi?
That is a huge question. We feel that we're getting closer, but in a way, the answer to that may be, will a deal be struck between President Erdogan and the Saudi royal family that will remove the need for the naked truth to finally be revealed to the whole world. If at the end of the day he receives what he wants, and we don't frankly know exactly what that is, he may have a long shopping list. It may be that at the top of that list is simply to undermine the crown prince, someone who clearly President Erdogan has grave suspicions about. But if that point is reached, then it is possible that we will never know the real truth of what happened to Mr. Khashoggi.
BBC diplomatic correspondent Paul Adams on the line from London. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
The Wall Street Journal is reporting that German Chancellor Angela Merkel has decided to open up her country to imports of natural gas from the United States, something President Trump suggested to loosen Russia's grip on Germany. Last year, Pennsylvania produced nearly 20% of America's natural gas, much of it through the drilling process known as fracking. One of the byproducts of that process is millions of gallons of wastewater, which is laden with toxic chemicals. And much of that wastewater gets trucked across the border from Pennsylvania to eastern Ohio, where it's pumped back into the ground. As Julie Grant of the Allegheny Front reports, residents in at least one Ohio county say they've had enough.
Michelle Garman used to marvel at the 22 acres of land around her home in Vienna, Ohio, less than 10 miles from the Pennsylvania border.
I would lean out my back window and look and say, oh my God, you know, I've never dreamed of owning this much land.
Garman didn't know much about fracking then, let alone frack waste disposal wells, but she had to learn quickly. An injection well was built on the property right next door.
Where you're looking at tanks and cement and fencing, it was trees and deer and turkey and blue jays. I never see them anymore.
Like many people around here, she remembers New Year's 2011.
Saturday's 4.0 quake near Youngstown, Ohio, comes one day after the state shut down operations at a fluid injection well.
That's a report from CNN. Fracking can cause its own problems with earthquakes, but the state determined that this and other smaller quakes around the same time period were from a wastewater injection well, similar to the one near Michelle Garman's house.
These are wells that are drilled, in many cases, several miles deep into the ground.
Mike Brodzinski is a seismologist at Miami University in Ohio and has been studying the connection between earthquakes and oil and gas activity in the region. Sometimes he says the disposal wells are drilled into deep, ancient bedrock known as basement rock.
Because it's very old, it has had a chance to be more faulted and, in essence, build up the energy that might then be released in the form of earthquakes.
The well believed to have caused the Youngstown quakes has been permanently closed. The state has since created new regulations on injection wells. Michelle Garman says big trucks carrying wastewater still squeal into the injection well next to her house at all hours. The brine contains chemicals like benzene, a known carcinogen. Garman fears for her family.
Most of my worry is, like I said, what's going in the ground. How does it affect our health, my son's health? I mean, it is toxic, what they're putting in. I mean, that is plain and simple poison that they're pumping into the ground.
She says her concerns haven't gotten much response from the Ohio Department of Natural Resources, known as ODNR, the agency with authority over the oil and gas industry. And few leaders in Vienna wanted to criticize the local company, Cleese Development Associates, that built the well next to her. But then, in April 2015, a spill. Dead fish, frogs, a turtle, a muskrat, and a sheen on the water in a pond and two wetlands. State officials found thousands of gallons of waste oil coming from another Cleese property.
People were scared. Can I drink the water? Can I bathe my children in it? Can I cook with it?
The state had Cleese shut down the injection well. The company could not be reached for comment, but Garman says that's when the community sentiment toward injection wells started changing. In late September, leaders from townships in Trumbull County in northeast Ohio gathered at the gazebo in the Brookfield Town Square. Brookfield trustee Gary Lease coached people to send letters to lawmakers in the state capital, Columbus.
This goes to the House, okay? Send it to this fellow here. This goes to the Senate, okay? Strictly to them.
They want lawmakers to consider legislation that would stop more injection wells in Trumbull County, which already has 17 among the most in the state, with six more in the works. State Representative Glenn Holmes says this area doesn't benefit from these wells, so it shouldn't have to be the dumping ground for other states' wastewater.
You're coming into a community that says we do not want this in any way, shape, or form, and you're forcing it onto them. So you have the truck traffic, you have the noise, and you also have the stress and the tensions. Is this going to cause an earthquake? Is my aquifer or my well going to be polluted because of this?
Holmes has proposed two bills in the Ohio House of Representatives. One would divert more than a third of fees Ohio collects from other states' frack waste disposal to local governments. Another bill would stop ODNR from permitting any more injection wells in Trumbull County. But the Ohio Department of Natural Resources says it has strong regulations for injection wells. A spokesperson declined an interview for this story, as did the industry group, the Ohio Oil and Gas Association. For Here and Now, I'm Julie Grant.
If you look across the country at all the races in the midterm elections, there's one that doesn't fit the mold. A Republican in a very blue state who is way ahead in the polls. In fact, Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker is the most popular governor in America. Again, a Republican in Massachusetts. He's facing Democrat Jay Gonzalez, and at last check is almost 40 points ahead of him in the polls. Anthony Brooks is senior political reporter for WBUR in Boston. He joins us. Hi, Anthony.
Hey, Jeremy.
Now, why is a Republican like Baker so popular in Massachusetts?
Well, what it comes down to is that he represents a brand of Republicanism that works really well in Massachusetts. He's relatively conservative on fiscal issues. He doesn't like raising taxes, but he's liberal on social issues like abortion rights and marriage equality. And he works well with the state legislature, which is dominated by Democrats. So in this age of hyper-partisanship across the country, Baker represents something very different that appeals not only to Republicans in this state, but according to our polls, to lots of Democrats and independents as well.
You'd probably call him a Democrat if he were in any other state. Here he is in a recent debate with Jay Gonzalez, talking about issues that matter to him, where he has to go against the president.
I've always been quite clear about where I stand on a whole series of things with respect to the president, and have managed to work pretty hard over the course of the past 4 years to stop some of the things that the Congress and the president was proposing that would have been particularly damaging to Massachusetts. The Affordable Care Act cuts, the cuts in the NIH, and cancer and other forms of research, and a lot of the work we did associated with the travel ban and immigration.
What more should we know about his politics?
Well, as we mentioned, he's moderate, fiscally cautious, socially liberal. By contrast, his Democratic opponent, Jay Gonzalez, wants to talk about big Democratic programs, raise taxes on the rich, invest billions in transportation, education, provide tuition-free college, and move towards single-payer health care system. Baker is much more cautious, a kind of cautious fiscal manager, presents himself as a responsible custodian of government. For example, he's made modest investments in early childhood education, an effort to fix the state's public transportation system, but he opposes the kind of big tax hikes and big programs that Gonzalez wants.
And Gonzalez is trying to remind people that Baker is, in fact, a Republican. Listen to this moment from that same debate when Baker refused to say whether he would vote in the election for Republican Jeff Deal, who is challenging Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren next month.
Are you going to vote for Jeff Deal?
Governor?
I'm going to vote for me, and I'm going to vote for Karen Pulido, and I'm going to vote for a series of other candidates as well. I don't know what I'm going to do yet with respect to that one.
You don't know if you're going to vote for the guy you endorsed?
I haven't made a decision.
Okay. Karen Pulido, by the way, that's his lieutenant governor.
That's right.
But this is a tough issue for Baker.
Really, that was an awkward moment for Baker. And it became even more so after the debate when he said that he misspoke and would vote for the Republican ticket, which would include a Deal. Now, Gonzalez is trying to link Baker to Deal and by extension to Trump. And this does put Baker in a kind of awkward position. This socially liberal, anti-Trump Republican who says he'll vote for Jeff Deal, the state's number one Trump supporter, the guy who co-chaired the Trump campaign in Massachusetts.
Does Baker have a relationship with President Trump?
No, they're not close. Baker didn't vote for Trump, as we mentioned. He's opposed several of his policies. But he argues that when he can work with the Trump administration, when it helps Massachusetts, he will. But this is a state that voted 2-1 against Trump. So Baker has to do a bit of a balancing act here when it comes to the president.
Now, Massachusetts has a history of moderate Republican governors, William Weld, Paul Cellucci, even Mitt Romney, who was governor and passed Romney Care, which was the model for Obamacare.
That's right. And Baker is part of that tradition of moderate Republicans that have had success in Massachusetts and across New England, for that matter. They included people like late Senator Warren Rudman of New Hampshire, Lincoln Chafee of Rhode Island, Olympia Snowe of Maine. Mm-hmm. They were known as, you know, Rockefeller Republicans, fiscally conservative, more socially moderate, even liberal. Baker is part of that tradition.
If Baker does win, what is the lesson, or is there one, for Republicans in other states?
Yeah, the lesson is that Republicans and Democrats can overcome this hyper-partisanship and work together and get things done. I think that's one lesson. That said, Baker's brand of moderate Republicanism is increasingly rare. Once upon a time, it represented a viable wing of the Republican Party that existed across the country. But now that wing is on the verge of extinction. So I think the lesson is Republican moderates like Charlie Baker are increasingly rare.
It's Anthony Brooks, senior political reporter for WBUR in Boston. Anthony, thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, a more traditional Republican is gaining ground on his Democratic opponent in the North Dakota Senate race. Kevin Cramer is ahead of Senator Heidi Heitkamp in the polls. Heitkamp won her seat in 2012 by fewer than 3,000 votes, and she had strong support from Native Americans. Which brings us to the Supreme Court, which declined to consider a challenge to a North Dakota law that requires voters to show proof of their residential address at the polls, putting the law into effect just weeks before the midterms. And that law could pose problems for many rural voters, many of them Native Americans. Danielle Tashina Finn is the director of external affairs for the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. She's also a citizen of the tribe. She joins us. Danielle, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jeremy.
So you say it's common on reservations for someone not to have a physical street address. Explain why that is for people who aren't familiar.
Yeah. So on the reservation, we're a very spread out community. And due to that, a lot of people do not live in townships or areas, communities that have a lot of people in them. So actually mailboxes are kind of uncommon. And because of that, most of the community members here, hundreds, if not thousands of people on Standing Rock, use P.O. box addresses and go to the post office to get their mail and count that as their actual address. So what we're facing here and what I believe is the voter suppression is that many people now have to get new IDs with an actual physical residential address.
So I want to get to that and how you're dealing with that issue. But first of all, do a lot of people who live on reservations tend to vote given that they don't have physical addresses in just before this year? Do they vote in big numbers?
Yeah, you can credit U.S. Senator Heidi Heitkamp's win in 2012 for the U.S. Senate seat of North Dakota to the Native American vote, where she won with less than 3,000 votes. And I can tell you here on Standing Rock, on the North Dakota side, we have 2,700 eligible voters, 18 and above, that are capable of voting in this election. In 2014, 1,200 people on Standing Rock voted. And so that tells you right there that if just one tribal nation alone votes, you know, predominantly with one party, that could swing an election.
So what are you trying to do to get tribal citizen voters eligible for this upcoming election, given this Supreme Court decision?
Yeah, so do based on the new law that North Dakota really imposed upon the tribal nations is we have to make sure that everyone has identification with their new residential physical address. So that entails either getting them a new ID card that's issued by the tribal government here, or we have to provide them supplemental material, whether that's a letter from the tribal agency, you know, tell them they need to bring a utility bill with them if they're going to use their old ID, and also making sure people do know their residential address. Because again, like I said, people here on the reservation, house numbers are not very common. A joke that my grandma was saying is that she actually did a permanent marker and marked her own house with her own numbers. So there you go.
The Republican-controlled state government in North Dakota says this law is about preventing voter fraud in the state, which is overall one of the easier states to vote in. What do you say to that?
I think that's comical because you have people now making up their own addresses because they do not feel like they should go to the sheriff, who is also our 911 coordinator and the only person in Sioux County who can issue an address. So they're making up their own addresses right now, which is voter fraud. So they just created a problem, basically.
And how long do people have to come up with a new address in order to vote this election day?
Yeah, so they have 2 weeks.
They can do this right up until the election day?
Correct, yep.
Uh-huh. So do you think that they will? Do you think you're going to get enough people registered to vote so that they all can have their voices heard?
Yeah, so we have same-day registration in the state of North Dakota, so we can have people just come in and get their IDs up until 7 o'clock on November 6th. And right now, I can tell you that we have a lot of people who have already gone to get their tribal IDs, of which we have been providing for free in order to help people vote. So, I mean, hundreds of people were affected by this law in Standing Rock, but thousands of people were affected across North Dakota. So we're already mobilizing and getting that couple hundred to get their new IDs.
Danielle, just big picture here, Native Americans have always faced unique challenges when it comes to voting. They were the last to gain suffrage in 1924, couldn't vote in states like Arizona, Utah, New Mexico until 1948. Is there still a feeling on reservations like yours that Native people aren't welcome in the electoral process?
Yes, for sure. I mean, we've faced voting problems all over the United States. In South Dakota, they've had many litigations about voter disenfranchisement. And I think in Montana, there was cases of voter suppression among Native people. And honestly, I think if Native people are constantly being turned away at the polls and having this many problems, it actually disencourages people from voting further. And I can tell you, my grandma has been turned away at the polls with her passport in 2014. And she felt like, why is it worth going back and trying time and time again?
That is Danielle Tashina Finn, who is the Director of External Affairs for the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. She's also a citizen of the tribe, and she joined us from North Dakota. Danielle, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy, for having me.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes. Set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
A group of Central American migrants is still moving north today through Mexico toward the U.S. border. The images have captured the attention of President Trump, who said yesterday that he'd cut aid to Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador after those countries failed to stop the migrants from leaving home.
Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, they're paid a lot of money every year. We give them foreign aid, and they did nothing for us, nothing.
The U.S. will send $180 million to those three countries combined in 2019. Ali Velshi is MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. He's also the co-host of Velshi and Rule. Ali, always good to have you.
Thanks, Peter.
So first, let's be clear. Any significant change to that $180 million funding stream, it's not just up to the president. He'd have to go to Congress and get them involved too, correct?
He'd have to go to Congress for half of it because Congress passed legislation last year that allows up to 25% of the aid that goes to those countries to be withheld if the Secretary of State doesn't certify to Congress that they're making progress reducing illegal immigration. So half, 25% can be held that way. But up to 50% of it can be withheld if the administration determines that the countries have run afoul of anti-corruption provisions. So there are a couple of technicalities, but they can actually, the administration can withhold up to 50% of the aid that goes to these countries without Congress.
Okay. And by the way, that $180 million is already less than what the U.S.
Correct.
Has pledged in past years.
That's right. In fact, foreign aid for the three countries the president's talking about is 40% less than what was allocated in 2016. So they're already getting a lot less funding from the U.S. than they did. Also, you know, the president's trying to push each of these three countries to enact reforms, to increase private investment so they're not as dependent on government money and stem the flow of immigrants. And he's also made a decision to cancel temporary work permits and legal status for about 250,000 Salvadorans and Hondurans who are already in the United States. Now, this hurts those countries because they depend so heavily on remittances from people who work overseas who then send money home.
And I'm taking a look at where the foreign aid goes. It goes to programs that help reduce poverty in those countries, help reduce violence, help reduce food insecurity. Those are the very problems that force people to migrate north in the first place. Could the president be making the problem worse for himself?
Yeah, absolutely. He could be. That the nuanced and sophisticated view of this is that there are problems in particularly Nicaragua, which is about to collapse, and further south in Venezuela. So there's a bit of a refugee asylum economic problem all through South and Central America right now. And you know, the same way the Syrians and Iraqis go to European countries, that's kind of the problem we've got here. We sort of need to try and figure out what this problem looks like in the host countries and with Mexico, who maybe in exchange for certain incentives might be able to settle more of these people. But yeah, doing it this way, cutting this funding, it will only exacerbate the problem.
But could the threat be a big enough stick for those countries who don't want to see that money not show up in their coffers to get them to do something more to keep those migrants at home?
That's definitely the approach Donald Trump has taken with kind of every issue that he's dealing with. You know, more sticks than carrots. We haven't heard from anything from these three countries, so we don't know whether they're considering policy changes. There's a technical problem because by treaty, citizens of Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala can move freely within each country without a passport. So you can't prevent them from leaving the country. Very few countries actually prevent people from leaving. We don't know yet what they're going to do.
MSNBC's Ali Velshi, thank you.
My pleasure.
Healthcare is a top issue in the midterm elections, which are 2 weeks from today. On the campaign trail, even Republicans who have voted to repeal the Affordable Care Act are making promises that they will continue one of the most popular parts of the law, making sure people with pre-existing conditions are able to get and keep their health insurance. The Affordable Care Act is still at risk of being dismantled, but a majority of voters wants to protect coverage for pre-existing conditions. Joining us now is Julie Rovner, who is Chief Washington Correspondent at Kaiser Health News. Hi, Julie.
Hey, Jeremy.
And let's step back a bit first. Before the Affordable Care Act was passed in 2010, who did and who did not have protections for pre-existing conditions?
Well, if you were going from job to job, if you had employer-provided insurance, then you had protections for pre-existing condition, either exclusions or being charged more, as long as you didn't have a break of more than 63 days. That was a 1996 law that Congress passed. What the Affordable Care Act did was that extended it to people who basically left their jobs for their own insurance, who wanted to leave to start a business or who were people who work for themselves or kids graduating from college and going off their parents' plans. The idea was that people should be able to get insurance regardless of whether they had a pre-existing condition, and they shouldn't have to pay more for it. Those were the two most important pieces of the pre-existing condition protections in the Affordable Care Act.
But back pre-2010, if you did leave your job and you did leave your health insurance for a period of time and you did have a pre-existing condition, diabetes, cancer, whatever it may be, what did that mean for you? Could you get insurance?
Possibly not, or you might have been able to get insurance, but it would cost much more, or you might have been able to get insurance, but it wouldn't cover your pre-existing condition. So there were a lot of sort of pitfalls if you were trying to buy your own insurance and you had been basically treated for a medical condition, sometimes as minor as acne.
So at this point, with some of the dismantling that has been done of the Affordable Care Act, that pre-existing condition protection is still in place, right? It basically, if you want health insurance, no matter what your pre-existing condition is in this country, you can get it.
It is. It is still in place. However, there is a lawsuit that is pending. We're expecting to hear from the judge in Texas pretty much any time. The lawsuit suggests that because of the tax bill last year that took away the fine for people who don't have health insurance, the entire Affordable Care Act is now unconstitutional, should be struck down. The Trump administration argued that they didn't quite agree with striking down the whole Affordable Care Act, but maybe they should strike down the pre-existing condition protection. So even though Congress didn't change it, there is still some threat that it could be changed in the courts.
Well, that brings us to the bigger picture here, which is that how can you say that you want to keep that one popular provision of the Affordable Care Act, which is the protection for pre-existing conditions, but you want to get rid of other key provisions? Does it work if you take little pieces of it away?
Well, it makes it difficult. I mean, that's basically what the Trump administration is arguing, that the insurance industry said, we can't afford to cover people with health problems unless we have a bigger pool of healthy people. That's what that tax was about. That's why there was an individual mandate. The individual mandate is now gone, and there is still some concern that only sick people will sign up for individual health coverage because it's expensive. The insurance companies appear to be betting that they're going to continue to hang on to at least the healthy people that they have because they're not raising premiums a whole lot for next year. We will see if that pays off. We will know more about that in 2019, about how well that actually works.
Meanwhile, let's listen to what President Trump has been saying. Here he is on the campaign trail at a rally in West Virginia last month.
And I will always fight for and always protect patients with pre-existing conditions. You have to do it. You have to do it. Some people think that's not a Republican thing to do. I don't care. And I'll tell you what, all of the Republicans are coming into that position now, all of them. And we'll do it the right way, too. Pre-existing conditions are safe.
Julie, is he right that all of the Republicans are moving into that position at this point?
Well, a lot of them are saying it, but what they have done suggests otherwise. And actually, just yesterday, the Trump administration put out a guidance that allows states to take these short-term plans that don't necessarily cover pre-existing conditions and let people get subsidies for them under the Affordable Care Act, which is not something that protects pre-existing conditions. It basically says that, okay, sick people, you're going to be segregated into these other plans and the premiums are likely to go up. So it's what they say and what they do not match this year. We will see whether voters can sort that out.
What about the Affordable Care Act overall? Is it likely that if Republicans keep control of both houses of Congress, that they are going to try again to repeal the whole thing?
I think that would be likely. I think there was some talk that they might try to do it in the lame duck session after the election. That seems unlikely because they're going to have the same Congress they had before when they didn't have the votes. But if they were to pick up seats, particularly in the Senate, then I think you would probably see another effort to do what Congress tried and failed to do in 2017.
Other than the pre-existing conditions part of the Affordable Care Act, what are the other really popular parts of the law that it would be difficult for Republicans to get rid of?
Well, the Republicans tried to go after the Medicaid expansion, and that turned out to be surprisingly unpopular. I mean, I don't think I would have guessed in 2015 that Medicaid would become a big political issue, and yet we have Medicaid now on the ballot in 4 states about either expanding or protecting an existing expansion. So the popularity of the Medicaid expansion, which gave health insurance to you know many millions of people, probably around 14 or 15 million people, is proving to be popular also. So there are other pieces of the Affordable Care Act that the public likes a lot. In fact, the only thing that the public really didn't like was that individual mandate penalty, which Congress got rid of last year.
Right. But the question is, again, whether the whole thing can stand up if you take away that part of it. I guess it has so far.
It has so far. That's right. The insurance company behavior suggests that it will be, or they're betting that it will be okay. We will have to see what happens in the courts.
The sign-up period for ACA health plans starts on November 1st, and for the first time since 2010, the price of health coverage through the federal marketplaces is down slightly. What's going on there?
Well, what's going on there is that insurance companies raised their rates so much last year for 2018 that they have no place else to go. They're finally starting to make money, so they don't really need to raise rates. In some cases, they're lowering rates at least slightly. Partly that's because under the Affordable Care Act, they're not allowed to raise rates unless they can justify the rate increases, which they can't this year. And the whole thing, it looks like, you know, there's a little bit of stability. But I should point out, it depends where you live. Rates are higher in some places still than in other places. Sometimes that's because last year's rates didn't go up so much. I would also point out that in some states, open enrollment has already started. In California, it started October 15th. So you really need to check your state to find out when open enrollment is, when it ends, and what the premiums are looking like.
What are you hearing from Democrats as we lead up to the election? Are you hearing people talk about universal health care as they were a couple years ago?
Well, Democrats are going to have a really big fight, I think, after the midterm. Right now, they're talking a lot about protecting pre-existing conditions. But there is this sort of nascent and growing move for Medicare for all or some kind of universal coverage. It's a phrase that means different things to different people. But clearly, the Affordable Care Act, while it expanded coverage to a lot of people, did not do enough about doing something about the price of health insurance and the price of health care in general, and the fact that the U.S. pays way more than other industrialized countries. And I think that's going to be the debate going forward. Democrats are going to have to decide whether they want to support a more government-run health plan or whether they can figure out a way to make the Affordable Care Act more robust and do something about health care spending in general.
Julie, while we have you, we learned today that the retired Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor has revealed in a letter that she has been diagnosed with the beginning stages of dementia, probably Alzheimer's disease, she says. This is something that affects so many Americans. What does it mean to have such a well-known person as Sandra Day O'Connor come out and say that this is impacting her as well?
Well, I think everyone is aware of this. I think everyone's family has been touched by someone with dementia or with Alzheimer's. Obviously, we saw President Reagan after he left the presidency. It is a big issue. You know, the one thing that the U.S. really does have in medicine and that there is bipartisan support for is government-funded research through the National Institutes of Health. And this is something that is a top priority for the NIH. It is obviously, you know, a tragedy for people connected to people with dementia. And it is also a huge source of spending for the United States. So definitely there is a lot of work going on that is broadly supported to find a treatment or a cure.
That is Julie Rovner, Chief Washington Correspondent at Kaiser Health News. Julie, thanks as always.
Thank you.
A world record $1.6 billion Mega Millions prize.
That jackpot just keeps getting bigger and bigger. And right now,
the Mega Millions lottery is up to $1.6
billion. $1.6 billion is up for grabs in the Mega Millions drawing.
A lot of buzz about tonight's drawing for the Mega Millions lottery. That $1.6 billion prize is the highest ever. The person or people who win can choose if they want their new fortune in one lavish lump sum or by an annual installment for 30 years. The states, of course, where the tickets were sold, will collect a handsome financial windfall as well. And that is what we're going to look at now with Liberty Vittert. She's a visiting assistant professor in statistics at Washington University in St. Louis. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
How much money are these states bringing in through the lottery?
So I think overall, we spend $73 billion a year on the lottery. So Missouri had a $1.3 billion revenue last year. New York had, I think, almost $3.2 billion.
And is that from ticket sales or taxes on the winnings?
Both. So that includes everything.
Aside from the very lucky person who wins this lottery, where do the profits from it go?
Well, states originally told us when they decided to create these lotteries that the money would be going as additional funding to public education. So even if you lose, which you're most likely going to, at least the money is going to go to some good causes, is going to help your children have a better education. But that's not exactly what happened.
And what do you mean? Because we're reading that about half of the states put their lottery profits towards education, but it's often not always seen as extra money. In fact, in many cases, it's like making up the basic revenue stream for the state's education budget. Is that right?
Exactly. We originally thought this was going to go to fund wonderful programs, increase spending per student, but instead it's really just funding the education budget. So, for example, in North Carolina in 2005, at the last second before the vote, they switched the wording from needs to go to additional funding for education to it's at the discretion of the state legislatures, which means in most states, spending per pupil is actually down, even though the lottery profits have skyrocketed.
Could you argue then that the lottery is essentially a tax, because that is the way that a state would traditionally fund an education budget?
I think that's a perfect argument, and especially sad, given that really this, you know, lotteries are played by the absolute lowest earners in our society. The average lowest earning household spends $415 on the lottery every year, in comparison to the highest earners, which spend about $100. So that means the lowest earners are spending four times what the highest earners are spending, meaning it's really a tax on the poor.
It's not just education that lottery money goes toward. We see in Colorado that it goes for environmental protection. What are some other examples?
Sometimes it can go to the VA. It can go for, I mean, really, I mean, it can go to a general budget. In North Carolina, they actually, the governor just spent $50 million and put it towards the general budget. So it's a really loose wording in many states with what exactly the money can go to.
What are the implications for using money in that way? Is it as good as any other stream of revenue?
Well, I guess you can argue it in many different ways, but, you know, gambling addiction is a real issue in our country, and especially when it's this tax on the poor, and in effect, a tax on the poor. It's a really worrisome trend, and it's also really worrisome that legislatures are in some ways at the mercy of the lotto and really need it to make money. And that's actually what happened in 2017. In order to make these jackpots bigger so that we're talking about it like we are today, they made it a lot harder to win so that the jackpots would skyrocket.
So are you saying that just because this is a record jackpot that we're looking at with this Mega Millions, $1.6 billion, that states aren't reaping even more money, or is it staying the same?
The states are reaping more money, but our education budget certainly is not in most states.
Huh. You write that about half of Americans play the lottery today compared to almost 70% in the 1980s. What's going on with that?
Well, I think people are getting smarter about how low their chances are. You know, if I tell you your chance of winning the Mega Millions is 1 in 300 million, that means nothing to you. But if I tell you that's the same as your chance of flipping a coin 30 times in a row and getting a heads every time, or you're three more times more likely to be killed by a vending machine than you are of winning the Mega Millions, it starts to make a lot more sense. We're getting smarter.
So what's your takeaway? Is the lottery a good thing for states and for all of us?
I think it really begs the question about whether lotteries are a good thing. And I think what's very worrisome is having state legislators sort of at the mercy of lottery funding. On that note, I did buy a ticket. I know I shouldn't, but I did, and I will be checking the numbers tonight. So I am just as guilty as anyone else.
Hey, it's a complicated world we live in, right? You know, you can say one thing and do another sometimes. Liberty Vitter is a visiting assistant professor in statistics at Washington University in St. Louis. Liberty, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
See, Jeremy, even a critic can't resist buying that ticket.
I'm still trying to figure out what my chances are of getting killed by a vending machine. I never thought about that before. But I will tell you, I was in an Uber the other day, and the driver said, if you won and you were getting married the next day, would you call off the wedding?
And he said?
He said, I would. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.